I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Since retiring from the Senate in 2012, former Greens leader Bob Brown has remained an activist and indeed intensified his efforts to preserve Australia's areas of wilderness. He travels the country, has written a couple of books, and continues to express his thoughts about the direction of the party he helped to found. Bob Brown has been at the Canberra Writers' Festival, and he joins us today in the studious confines of the National Library. Bob Brown, good to see you again. You gave the closing address at the festival, but it was something a bit out of the ordinary. You brought your own choir, which gave a rendition of a suggested national anthem that you wrote in your young days, your salad days. Tell us the story.
Hello, Michelle. Well, it's lovely to be talking with you again. Yes, I had a choir, what a good lot, called the it's a Get Together Earth Choir, Random Earth Choir from Canberra, under the direction of Chris Sainsbury. And it was his version, if you like, his variation of the, or put together of a choir, a choral version of my Earth song. I wrote this song as a 16-year-old. It was a piece of music that I put together when I was 16. And then I entered in Gough Whitlam's quest for a new national anthem. And that, back in the 70s, they got 7,000 entries. They asked for the words first, and Bob Ellis, the late lamented Bob Ellis, was on the panel, and they threw out all 7,000 and gave up before they even asked for the music. So there was then a plebiscite on the three songs, Waltzing Matilda, A Song of Australia, and Advance Australia, and hence we've got Advance Australia as our national anthem. Well, the piece of music was sitting there, and as I was about to retire from the Senate, I thought, our planet needs an anthem. Every country's got an anthem. We'll go to war with the anthem behind us, but we need cohesion on this planet. As you know, I'm a globalist, and I think that it would be good to have a song about the Earth, and this is it. I put some words to it, and yesterday the choir sang that at the Canberra Writers' Festival, which was quite delightful. It's a celebratory song about this one little speck of splendour, this planet Earth, which so far as we know is the only one amongst billions in the universe that's got life on it. And we either work together on this planet to make sure it sustains humanity into the future, or we'll fail. So it's a case of let's get together. The old asseveration, a house united will stand.
And of course, your reference to the plebiscite reminds us that amid all the talk of a possible plebiscite on same-sex marriage, that was the last time Australia had a plebiscite.
That's correct. And it did lead to a conclusion which I think most Australians now would think was a good one. Before that, we used to stand up to God Save the Queen at the pictures and everywhere else at sporting grounds. And now we've got Australia, despite the dispute over Girt by Sea, etc., we've got a song that people like and is unifying.
Mind you, many people want to Waltzing Matilda.
Well, I voted for it. But the words, I think, deterred people from... the words are
a bit provocative.
A story, yes, and they wanted something more stirring about the country itself, and they got Advance Australia Fair out of that.
Now, one of your other enduring interests, apart from politics, has been that you're a keen photographer, and you're now working with the National Library on a project involving photographs. Tell us about that.
Yes, Michelle, the National Library has been given the collection of perhaps... Well, Australia's most renowned, internationally renowned wilderness photographer, Peter Dombrovskis, whose widow Liz has seen the collection come here. There's over 2,000 of these large transparencies. They're 5 inches by 4 inches that he took with a Linhof camera, and they include that remarkable morning mist at Rock Island Bend on the Franklin River, which was so instrumental in helping the Hawke government come to power in March 1983. That picture was printed more than a million times during the Franklin campaign, and rafters going down the Franklin River these days, which is a huge international attractant to Tasmania. It's been listed as the top one of the top 10 world's most raftable rivers for tourists because of its wildness, essentially. It's not the biggest, but it's the wildest. And there's this, they want to see Rock Island Bend, and there it is. It's instead of being flooded for a pittance of electricity, it's there in what these days is Tasmania's booming industry, the thing that's taking Tasmania out of the bottom of economic and employment industries in Australia and moving us up through the crowd. Is we now have more than 1 million visitors, and it's the natural attraction, the World Heritage Area, that's bringing those people to Tasmania, creating local investment, creating jobs. So we've got an environmental outcome there which has flowed very clearly to a great economic and employment outcome for the island state.
And the book will be a collection of these photos?
Yes, the National Library intends to have an exhibition of Peter's photographs in about September next year, 2017, and they kindly asked me to write the foreword because I knew Peter so well, and I ran into his adult son, Nicholas, who's now a global photographer himself, and asked him if he'd write me a few words about his dad, and he did. You know, I thought, what else is there to write about Peter Dombrovskis? There's been a number of books about him. And I was able to incorporate the experiences of the boy going into the wilderness with his father. So it's very nice, very engaging, and I'm very pleased to have just delivered that forward to the book, and I'll be talking about folk here at the library, in fact, in an hour or two, about this project as it comes to fruition.
Now, of course, we must turn to federal politics. After 9 years in the job, last week, Sarah Hanson-Young, whom you worked with for a long time, was forced to give up her immigration portfolio in the reshuffle in the Greens. Do you think that the Greens need to shift at all their messaging on this issue?
No, I don't. I think that one thing that Sarah said since she was given the education portfolio instead is that sometimes you have to stand with what is right, not necessarily what is popular. And I think that's true. And in fact, I spoke about the heartlessness of the current Minister for Immigration, Dutton. He was, you know, the single member of Parliament who refused to vote for the expression of apology by Kevin Rudd back then. The only person. And yet here he is now, Minister for Immigration, overseeing deliberated cruelty to fellow human beings, including children, on Nauru. This is a blight on Australia that we're going to live to regret further down the line. I think Sarah's done a great job, and I'm sure Nick McKim, in turn, will do that. His first move in the new portfolio is to want to go to Nauru and Manus Island and see for himself. We have to put an end to it, and the Greens have been the party, and Sarah's been a great advocate for that all the way down the line. And I think she's helped move this nation from feeling, oh, you know, let's forget about those people, to saying, no, we can't. They're under our care. The government's responsible. That is, the people are responsible for what's happening there, and we've got to change it.
Were you sorry to see her moved?
Well, look, I was sorry to see her moved because she's done such a fine job in that portfolio. On the other hand, I think it's a very, very daunting job. You know, you are dealing with the agony and suffering of men, women and children, and she's been doing that for years. So in a way, it might end up being a hidden blessing. She's still a young woman. She's one of the outstanding advocates, not only in the Greens, I think in the Senate and the Parliament. I think she'll do a great job in education, but I think it'll free her a little. You know, I just think it's a harrowing job to have. She's had it now for two terms of Parliament, and she didn't want to give it up. You know, Nick McKim's got big shoes to fill there. But I think at a personal level, and she'll do a great job in education and trade. She's got that as well. It'll bring a little bit of more pleasure into the portfolio she has to deal with.
During your parliamentary and pre-parliamentary life, you were seen as a charismatic leader, both in Parliament, leading your party, and in the wider environmental movement. What kind of leaders do you think the Australian public are looking for at the moment?
Look, I think they're looking for people who stick to their guns, who do what they say they're going to do. And carry that through, sometimes, even if they're unpopular. Mind you, you always have to be able to change your position if new information says, well, it warrants changing. But it seems that modern politics is so much based on opinion polling and so on, and I don't think... let me put it this way. Australia is the wealthiest... We are the wealthiest people in dollar terms ever to have existed in the history of humanity. And we've got this huge resource base behind us. We're one of the best educated peoples that have ever existed. And we've got one of the world's oldest continuous democracies. And yet we're laggards in so many ways on the world scene. We're not a new Norway or a new Switzerland. We should be, or a new Iceland. But we have the opportunity to be world leaders in a world that's changing rapidly, where society is globalised, and where we can do better than leave it to the corporations to determine policy. And let's face it, Michelle, they do. They have entree to ministers' offices in a way that community organisations or people who are thinking about the where this great country could levy, as a middle order power, could levy its influence. We should be an independent nation, by the way. We have this ability to be a trailblazer in so many ways, and we're failing to do it. And I just think on the international scale, Australians have a position of being proud of what this nation does, instead of being disgusted, as so many people are about what's happening on Nauru, for example. We have the ability to have an independent policy front to the world. What a mistake it was that John Howard took us into the Iraq War. And you might remember, I stood against that, and I spoke as the leader of the Greens to rallies of hundreds of thousands of people in Sydney and Melbourne and Hobart and elsewhere. We can do better as a nation in a world that needs leadership, recognising that the 7 billion people on this planet have a common destiny. And if we fight with each other, we won't reach it. We're in an exciting age of technology, of mass communications, of space travel and exploration, of innovation in entertainment. There's just so much, and a huge demand that we protect what's left of the natural environment in a world threatened by climate change, for example. Why are we at the back of the pack? Instead of this is that we are now in the hottest recorded year in human history. Last year was the hottest before this one. The year before that was the hottest before that one. We're seeing the damage and destruction on the Barrier Reef, the loss of species, the collapse of fisheries. And yet, it's like business as usual. Australians need security in the future. When we get leaders who map out a plan that's going to give security not just of the economy, but of the environment and of society generally, will get there. And you cannot have that security unless you've got a secure environment. Climate change is going to do the reverse of saving the Franklin. If we don't haul it in, it's going to be a massive economic impost on us. Look at the predictions that 90% of the productivity of the Murray-Darling Basin will be lost on current climate change projections. And yet here we are discussing dismantling more of ARENA, dismantling more of the good things the Gillard government brought in together with the Greens, and I was leader of the Greens at that time, which made us temporarily world leaders, temporarily. And that's because Julia Gillard had the flexibility to change. She copped it from the Alan Joneses and the Tony Abbotts of the world, but she was right. And we did innovate to give Australia a lead, but the Australian people voted for a government that then came in and dismantled that. Now, governments are only as good as the people who vote them in. And so it's not just, I hear so much about how bad our politicians are. Well, the voters have got a responsibility here. We all, as individual Australians, have got a... And if we simply vote for what we think is going to line our pockets at the time and let the devil take the rest of the future, well, we're going to fail.
What's your assessment of Malcolm Turnbull as a leader?
He should have stood up to the right wing at the outset and said, at the end of 2015, you either come with me or we'll all go out together. You know, people had great hopes in him. I remember when that change came and he, amongst the Greens, there was this feeling...
Did you have great hopes?
Yes, I did. I thought he would do better than he's done. But he didn't. You know, he allowed the George Christensens and Eric Abetz and Bernardis of the world to... I don't know what the bargain was, but whatever it was, he allowed and continues to allow them to dictate so much of policy. And I saw the quote the other day, I think in the Saturday paper, from Bob Menzies saying he was establishing a Liberal Party, which was neither going to be reactionary nor conservative. Well, we now have a reactionary and conservative government. I don't think that's where Malcolm Turnbull wants to be. I think he would prefer to be a Bob Menzies. And his time's running out. He either will stand up to that group of right-wing, the power base of right-wing reactionaries and conservatives, or he'll be another Prime Minister who failed to reach their promise. And Australia deserves a very progressive, liberal-minded leader. Turnbull's got it in him, but one wonders if he's had the life experience to be able to say, well, I'm not going to be dictated to any... It's pretty late in the piece. I'm not going to be dictated to by these right-wingers. I will stand up to them. And if I lose out as a result of that, at least I've tried.
You spoke before of Australia being a laggard on issues. One social issue where clearly we're behind a number of comparable countries is legalising same-sex marriage. Now, it looks as though the plebiscite is not going to get off the ground. The Greens and probably Labor, it seems, will knock that out in the Senate and some Senate crossbenchers. What's your view of that, and do you think that it's better to wait than have a plebiscite?
Well, Michelle, the first thing to be said is Parliament should always have dealt with this. And you know, I was there in, I think, about 2001 when Labor joined with John Howard as Prime Minister to discriminate in marriage. They changed the Marriage Act to... It didn't say this before. It said, you know, the Commonwealth's in charge of marriage and people can get married. But they changed it to disqualify everybody except a man and a woman becoming married. That didn't go to a plebiscite. Now we're in the position where changing it back to neutrality so that so that any two people who love each other can get married has got to go, we're told, to a plebiscite. Now, the Parliament should deal with it. However, if push comes to shove, I think the door should be kept open. I don't...
For a plebiscite?
For a plebiscite, because I think it's the wrong way to go. But I think that down the line... There's three more years of waiting. And we're told that the LGBTI community is going to suffer horrendous insults if we go to a plebiscite. Day in, day out, that is the case. You know, I'm gay, so I understand what people put up with that, and certainly in past times, it's been no fun at times. However, I worry about allowing this to continue for year after year. The Irish experience, by the way, was that they had a plebiscite. The Catholic Church opposed same-sex marriage. But at the end, when the people did vote for same-sex marriage, it was a national endorsement. So the people... And the second thing that's... There's a curious thing going on here, because I think the majority of people do want to have a say. Mind you, they're balking at hundreds of millions of dollars being spent on a job that Parliament should do at a time when we're told we need budget repair. So there's so many arguments against a plebiscite for Parliament getting on and doing the job. Malcolm Turnbull, where are you? This is your own inclination. You should insist that there be a vote in the Parliament and a free vote of your members, and you should put your leadership on the line about it and get this over and done with, and the nation will be grateful to you if you do it. But if that's not to be the case, we have to think again about leaving it on the, as the Conservatives, the George Christensens of the world, and the Christian lobby, etc., want it. Oh, let's put it off in the hope that it'll never happen. Again, that leaves Australia at the back of the pack, and it leaves a percentage of Australians denied their rights.
So better to have the plebiscite if there's no other way this term of Parliament to get changed.
If it gets to that point. Now, I know the Greens have determined that that's not something that they will support, and I've given all the reasons as to why they've come to that conclusion. But in politics, if the worst comes to the worst, you have to sometimes review how you're going, and we'll see.
The Greens didn't really do as well as they might have in the election. They talked up their prospects beforehand, but in fact didn't win any extra lower house seats, and the double dissolution meant that, in fact, they ended up a net one seat worse off in the Senate. You've been critical particularly of the New South Wales branch of the Greens. You've called for Lee Rhiannon, Senator Lee Rhiannon, to stand down in the past. What do you think needs to be done to make sure that the Greens don't slide, that they haven't passed a peak?
Oh, well, they haven't passed their peak, and I think Richard Di Natale is doing a great job as a leader, and I get enormous feedback to that effect. And Adam Bandt, as the lower house member, is a terrific performer, and he's now taking on climate change, and that's a good thing because it is such a huge issue. That said, you know, if a few people in the New South Wales Greens had had their way, we would have no leader. They still don't. We've got seven members in the New South Wales Parliament, no leader. There would be no party room rules as we've got set up. That would have been voted down. There's no integrated national party office that's able to deliver on a daily basis as Labor and the Liberals did during election campaign. You know, we need to move to the same footing as the great national party that the Australian Greens are. And that's been held back. And, you know, a lot of it's been based on let's not have any public discussion about this. My view is that the public needs to be taken into account, because I think a lot of Greens members in New South Wales have been let down. In fact, I know. I get stopped in the street in Sydney on occasions and people say, well, I'm a Green voter, but not while the current persons, and they'll name one or two people that are there, and I think it's time. You know, I left when things were, I think, going well. I think after 30 years, just a few people moving out of the New South Wales Greens Party, they've been there since the 80s, blocking the Australian Greens innovation and growth as a party at every turn. If they were to move it off the court at this stage and gracefully retire, we'd all be better off.
Do you think that the Greens need to open up the party to outside scrutiny? I know that when you were leader, you had this position of your conferences not being open. There have been pressures to be more transparent. What do you think about that?
Oh, look, that's a two-edged sword. I was always in favour of those meetings being open, but the membership voted to keep them closed, because the people, the rank and file members who come along don't want to be have microphones in their faces and cameras on them. Now,
but they do at the Labor conference, the Liberal councils?
Yes, they do, and that's why I'm in favour of it. But the membership kept voting it down, and so it was a simple democratic process there, Michelle.
What do you think about the relationship with the Labor Party? It's become really fractious and probably getting more so, especially from the Labor side. And yet during the election campaign, when the possibility of a hung parliament was raised, the Green leadership was interested in some sort of power sharing. How do you see that going, that relationship?
Oh, Labor's got to get over it. It should look at what happens with its colleagues and how its colleagues work in New Zealand, where there's just been a pact between Labor and the Greens in opposition to say they'll work together when they win government off Prime Minister Key in the next election or whenever. It's just being practical and saying to people, if we get elected, we will use our position to empower you as voters, to make your vote work to the best of our ability. And so, yes, in Tasmania in 1989, we went into a power-sharing arrangement, didn't have ministries at that stage, but we had a list of measures we wanted through, and we got them through. Labor and the Field government, even though Michael Field got an Order of Australia for his economic management, which was because the Greens were there to see us through a very nasty recession in the early 90s, didn't like the idea that we also had environmental gains, which, as I explained earlier, are now the backbone of the Tasmanian economy. They've got to get over it. You know, they're used to fighting factions within each other and winner takes all, but they had to come to a sharing arrangement. And these days, the most likely thing, by the way, is that Labor and Liberal get together in a grand coalition, as we've seen in Germany, because they're so like each other. It's the Greens who bring the difference to Australian politics. But the big parties have got to get used to the fact that more and more people are going to vote away from them. We're into a period of shared government, and certainly the Senate. It's very hard to see the Senate going back to a majority for either party, and they've got to work out how to share a little the power that they've got, because that's what Australians vote for.
Now that you've looked at the system from outside for a few years, do you feel that it's getting harder to get things done in government or by governments?
No, I think the leadership's lacking. I don't think it's harder. I think some of the commentary goes to lowest common denominator. I just don't think it's a business of the body politic, but I think it's a business of the media and the commentary, and you know, the shock jocks that we got these days and the right wing commentary. We're going through a phase. I think that'll change, but. No, I think it's up to... politics has always been the art of compromise. And I think it's up to politicians to honour the vote of the people of Australia, both in the House. The House should be by proportional representation. It should be one person, one vote, one value, and you don't get that under the current system. It should be proportional representation, like the elections in the ACT and in Tasmania and in New Zealand and in Europe, continental Europe. However, Labor in particular hates the idea of equal vote for people, and they're not about to do that. That said, we are going to see more Greens, for example, in the lower house in future elections, and the big parties, and more independents, I think, and the big parties have got to get used to that. Not just used to it, they've got to mature to the point where they say, we will utilise this and take it into account. We'll come to an arrangement straight after elections, which is publicly accountable and on the public record, and then we'll get on with the business of governing. Because that's the true representation of how the people voted. That's what democracy's for.
Bob Brown, thank you for talking with us today. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thanks to my producer, Pat Hutchins. And we'll take you out today with an earlier rendition of the Bob Brown anthem. Goodbye for now.
It gave us birth, and in the morning sun to our window, that magic feeling alive on earth. Eagles are soaring above the mountains, whale songs are sounding deep in the sea. it's free. Wonderful planet, life's revelation, a sunlit garden, wild rivers fall, a one and only home in the universe, this speck of splendor.
Just like